Noah, the Ark, and a worldwide flood are hot topics once again. Hollywood has offered their take on Noah, as well as other biblical themes. Authors are once again exploring the records and creating new research in the field. All of this raises the age-old question: is Noah, the Ark, and a worldwide flood myth or reality? Stay tuned for my conversation with author Mark Combs next on Soaring Eagle Radio.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher, and when you do, we appreciate it if you'd leave a review and a rating. Of course, you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. That is at Soaring Eagle Rad. And you can listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. My guest on this episode is Mark Combs. He's a critical investigative researcher who is fascinated by ancient mysteries, biblical history, and the origins of man. He's an author, public speaker, blogger, and publisher. In January 2015, he published his first book, End the Beginning, a non-fictional critical research volume that examines the evidence for Noah's great flood. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Mark.
Mike, thank you so very much. It's an honor to join you.
Well, it's a privilege for me to have you on the show, Mark. I appreciate you sending me a copy of your book, and I did read it. And I can't say that about every book that I receive in the mail from folks. But this one I did. I read the whole thing. I was very impressed with your research, and so we want to dive into some of that tonight. And I'd like to start, Mark, if we may, with this question. Of all the topics that you could have chosen to research, what prompted you to choose Noah and the flood narrative?
Well, I think there were a couple of factors there. Number one, this is a polarizing subject, as you've already mentioned.
Yeah.
There are people that are adamantly on one of two sides, either blind faith, support, and acceptance, or open mockery and ridicule.
Yes.
And my thought was there are many things about this story that I had heard growing up in the church, being taught some light study into the different Old Testament representations of these things, that there were many things that left me with a number of questions. And some of these were the very questions that get brought up by those who would be critical of the story.
Yeah.
And I felt like that some of these questions were legitimate questions, and as such, they deserved honest research and reasonable and responsible answers. And so the book itself is really my journey into this, part of it being because I had questions within myself that I wanted to go in search of reasonable, responsible answers to these questions and see where the evidence leads.
Yes, and one of the first things that that we have to say about the story of Noah and the flood and the ark is that it's really been, and you can agree or disagree with this, Mark. This is my take on it. It's really been, as it's been presented in church, especially Sunday school classes, it's really been misrepresented. It's not a nice, tidy, happy story at all, is it?
Well, no, and that's one of the things that troubled me. I mean, because it really is something that we teach the younger kids. I remember seeing it as a flannel graph lesson, and obviously there are a lot of children's books on Noah and the Ark. You'll probably see them in a lot of the retail stores. Yes. Around this time of the year, you know, as Bible stories for children. Well, the ark with the animals and the rainbow,
yes,
you know, always gets that front and center cover picture. But as I started digging into it, this really isn't a feel-good children's story at all. And it's a very serious, deep, dark tale that the more I researched, the more I understood.
Yes. Yeah. Now, you present some very compelling evidence concerning the ark's ability to float. I was really impressed with some of the engineering calculations that you made and presented in the book. Very detailed to, and I don't know if you were trying to satisfy your own curiosity or if you were trying to answer critics or if you're just trying to say, listen, it is quite probable, not just possible, but quite probable that the details that we have about the ark make it a very, very seaworthy vessel. Could you speak to that, Mark?
Yeah, this is one of the things we approached in the very first chapter of the book, which, Mike, to be honest, is my least favorite chapter in the entire book. But it's the elephant in the center of the room that says, yeah, hey, you've got to tackle me because, like it or not, I'm a central figure to this story. Mm-hmm. One of the most criticized critical aspects of the story of Noah and the Ark centers around the boat itself. Mm-hmm. You know, from every aspect of it, yeah, from the can it be built, would it float, would it survive, you know, seaworthiness over a long period of time, would it hold enough animals to produce what we have today? I mean, from every angle, shots are taken at this, and I felt like that before I could deal with anything else, I had to resolve some issues about the ark itself. And that's why we spent so much time with it in chapter one, trying to sort out, you know, the sheer magnitude of the project. And I really wanted to try to bring it to light so that anyone reading it could basically step inside the footprint of the ark and have a different appreciation and understanding for it.
Yes, and you mentioned something called the golden ratio, and that was something new for me. I was not familiar with that, and especially the golden ratio as it relates to the length and the width and the height of the ark. What is that exactly, and what's the significance of that?
Well, the golden ratio is something that really came into light in our modern-day shipbuilding. The golden ratio, mathematically, is a ratio of 30 units in length by 5 units in width by 3 units in height. Now, in the case of the Ark, we're talking about 300 units by 50 units by 30 units, and the unit of measure was a cubit, and we had to also try to get a good understanding and a translation of, you know, the approximate length of a cubit. And I tried to do that by digging into some archaeological research. And obviously the estimation that I picked up there is simply an example of something to go by. It was a rod that was unearthed in the ancient city of Nippur, which is near Baghdad. And it was a standard of measure that is identified as a cubit. It was a rod that was unearthed that had measurement marks on it. So I wasn't going by the general definition of from the length of a fingertip to the point of the elbow. I was going by an artifact that had been, and an artifact that had been found in the general part of the world where it's believed that the Ark came to rest. So I felt fairly safe in taking that particular measurement, which is a little in excess of 20 inches, just a little in excess of 20 inches, but it gives us a boat that's over 500 feet in length, over 85 feet wide. I think it's 86 point something feet wide and 51 feet in height. This ratio, this golden ratio, was popularized with the building of the SS Great Britain in 1843. And the SS Great Britain was hailed as a prime vessel for seaworthiness, and many ships later copied this golden ratio of 30 by 5 by 3. And in the shipbuilding, it almost became the blueprint to go by for a long time, including an American warship, the SS Jeremiah O'Brien, which was built along these same lines with many ships for World War II. The Jeremiah O'Brien was used during the Normandy invasion and later docked in San Diego and 50 years later sailed under its own power back to the shores of Normandy for the 50th anniversary. So this particular ratio is very stable when it comes to shipbuilding. One of the things that I really had to wrestle with as I was looking at the critical side of this, is that the premise when it comes to the Ark is that primitive man could not have accomplished such a task. And that being the underlying premise kind of leaves us with a negative connotation overall that's very difficult to overcome. And I felt like I needed to set a little bit of a different tone. So I went in search of some examples, the golden ratio being just one of them. But the big question that they kind of stuck with me is, how do we determine what primitive or ancient man, in this case, pre-flood humanity, how do we determine what they didn't know?
That's right, yeah.
We're kind of blinded with the concept that we're intelligent and sophisticated, and that the people who lived thousands of years ago were working with limited knowledge and couldn't possibly have been highly skilled. And I think that's really short-sighted on our part, and it blinds us to a lot of things that were documented in the ancient world.
Yes.
And we tried to give some examples of those as we went. One of the examples I didn't get into the book, Mike, that I actually came across after the book was in publication through a conversation with someone else who took me to task on some of the examples that I did put in the book. I included the H1 Hercules. It was called the Spruce Goose was a name for it, the Flying Lumberyard.
Yeah.
It was a plane that was built entirely out of laminated wood, similar to a fiberglass technique, but entirely out of laminated wood. And I use that as an example because many scholars believe the term gopher wood actually refers to a process rather than a type of wood. So I pulled that as an example. I mean, it was called the Hercules because it was a humongous plane. So I pulled that as an example, but someone else pointed me into another direction. After the book had already gone to publication, of the treasure ships of ancient China that sailed the seas in the 1200s. This dates back, you know, to an ancient time where we would say man was more primitive and less developed than we are today, back beyond the Middle Ages to the 1200s. And a gentleman by the name of Zheng He. Now, Chinese spelling of that is, in case any of your listeners want to research this and look it up, the Chinese spelling of his name is the letter Z-H-E-N-G, capital H-E, second name. It's pronounced Zheng He, and the Chinese treasure fleet. He had a large fleet of ships that were built entirely of wood, seagoing vessels that sailed the seas and the oceans, documented history from the people of China. Many of these ships were in excess of over 400 feet in length.
Wow.
something that is just a part of our not so distant history mm-hmm. that we overlook because we have the premise that we are intelligent and sophisticated, and people who lived before us were working with limited knowledge and couldn't possibly have been highly skilled. Well, mm-hmm. truth is, they were very highly skilled.
Yes, yes. Those are wonderful examples, and I do encourage our listeners to go do that research on their own. A couple of other things that stuck out, Mark, that you pointed out that a lot of people probably don't consider when they're thinking of the Ark is that it really was a rudderless vessel, if you will. It was built to float, not designed to be steered. And Noah likely used stones as ballast to keep the Ark moving in the right direction with the waves. But they also served another purpose that you pointed out in the book.
Yeah, this is something that, so many people say, well, the Ark just couldn't have sailed and couldn't have handled the rough seas. And the dimensions that were given in the Old Testament account really define for us a box, not a ship that is built according to the specifications that we look at, but a long rectangular box. And it really was designed to float. It wasn't going on a journey from point A to point B. It was designed to stay, above the waves. That was, the sole accomplishment. Mm-hmm. But I did some research into what I refer to in the book as drogue stones. That's kind of a common name given. And the purpose of those would be to provide some stability. But in my research, you come so many times, we get so familiar with scripture passages, and we read through them over and over until we just read past things that are screaming at us from the text, and we never see it. And one of those is in Genesis chapter 7, verses 19, 20, and following, where it talks about the water rising above the highest mountains. Now,
yes.
This brings in an argument of some folks saying, hey, this was a localized flood, a global flood. Well, you know what? I struggle with that because it does specify above the highest mountains, above all the mountains under the heavens, yes. and in numerous places. The first words from the Lord to Noah, the end of all flesh.
Yeah.
I can go back to my elementary education and blame it on my second, third, fourth grade teachers, where I was taught that all means all.
Right.
I don't want to oversimplify it, but when you get to Genesis chapter 7, you get even more definition. It says all flesh died that moved upon the earth, mm-hmm. and that means all. And it follows that up, just in case we miss the message there. Every creeping thing, I think every means every,
yep.
it says every man. And then the following verse, just in case we've missed it, says all that was in the dry land died.
Yeah.
So I really think this was a global flood.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we read past that just kind of jumped out at me in that passage in those verses, verse 20 says that the water rose 15 cubits above the highest mountain. And I wondered, how in the world did they know that it was 15 cubits above
right.
the highest mountain?
That's
well,
right.
It seems like if you're dragging something that's on a rope that's 15 feet long and it never hits bottom,
perfect.
Then you're at least 15 cubits above the highest mountain that's covered by water. So
yes.
that was one of the things we tried to point out with the drogue stones.
Yes.
And I think they were used, and I think they did serve a great purpose. We made some other illustrations in the book as well, including, I think, a reference to a program that was produced by National Geographic. You may remember thinking
yes.
about it as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the other, and I hesitate to call it a myth, Mark, but one of the details that has grown over the years related to the story of Noah and the building of the Ark itself is the fact that Noah was a preacher of righteousness, and so he would daily, as scoffers would come by to ridicule and insult and make fun of him and this thing that he was building, that he would tell them to repent day after day after day for all of those years. The facts are that he probably constructed this ark in isolation, didn't he?
It would be reasonable to think that, given the situation that you're in. I think the idea, Peter does proclaim Noah as a preacher of righteousness, but yeah. I remember from the Sunday school lessons that Noah stood and preached and, to all of mankind as he was building the ark. Now, I'm not sure if he was hammering with one hand and rightly divided King James Version of the Bible with the other, but, preacher of righteousness is something that is prominent. In fact, even in many of the Hollywood reproductions of this tale, you will see that Noah is trying to, speak to those around him and convince those around him that there's a flood coming. I really, in all of my study, one of the things that I could see that was very, very clear was that the earth was a extremely violent place.
Yes.
It was a struggle between a group that we'll talk about in just a few minutes, I'm sure, the Nephilim.
Yes.
Mankind. And mm-hmm. this was not a comfortable atmosphere on any level. The book of Jasher does indicate that Noah did go to the sons of men and proclaim a message to them. In fact, Methuselah stood with him, according to the book of Jasher. But I think once the message was rejected, it would seem reasonable to believe that once Noah started this project, he did so in seclusion for a number of reasons, not the least would be to avoid conflict. I don't know if any of your listeners may have seen the Hollywood production of Noah starring Russell Crowe that came out a little over a year ago, but one of the scenes in that even showed a conflict between a group led by a man that they called Tubal Cain, which was a descendant of Cain,
mm-hmm.
a group that wanted to, to take the ark. Just a portrayal of conflict there. I have a hard time envisioning that. I really do. I feel like that once it came time for the project to get underway, that a very specific place had to be sought out, and it had to be a place where there was at least a reasonable amount of solitude. You also had to have a place where this vessel could be built. It wasn't something that somebody was going to build in their backyard. It's a huge vessel, and you had to have a place that would provide you with the lumber resources to build it. So I think seclusion was a part of this project.
Yeah, you mentioned too, Mark, that your calculations based on the size of the vessel, you calculated approximately 24 acres of woods would be needed for the wood just for the ark.
I tried to really just sit down and do a little bit of math, and I didn't want to get too complicated in that or too detailed. I really didn't want to bog down in the details, but just going by the basic length of the ark, the width of the ark, the height of the ark, I tried to calculate how much lumber would it take to just encircle the outer hull of the ark. And that's where that, calculation came into being as I worked my way through that, in excess of 20, somewhere around 25 acres worth of lumber. That's a staggering amount. When I stopped to think about it, I had to come up with a visual of, okay, how big is 25 acres? So I'm a very visual person, Mike. That probably, bared itself out in
yes.
But I wanted to be able to put myself inside the footprint of the ark. And so that's why we kind of went through those extra steps in the early parts of the book.
Yeah. You mentioned just a few moments ago the Nephilim, and I appreciate you taking time to really address the topic of the Watchers and the Nephilim in your book, and you do a very good job of tying them into the Noah narrative. You give a great timeline, including Methuselah, Enoch. I'd like for you, Mark, to describe or explain for our listeners when the Watchers appeared, what patriarch or what figure was living at the time, and when they fell, and the outcome of that.
Well, the Watchers and the Nephilim are two kind of hot button topics and terms that have really come to the forefront over the last few years.
Yes.
There are those who are a very conservative scholarly taste that would say that that is a sensationalization of the scriptures, that the scriptures don't really paint this tale. There are those who say that the idea that angels and human beings can produce a hybrid race is totally unscriptural, heretical. And I had to deal with that because I wanted to be fair with both sides. There are also those who would jump on the bandwagon of the Watchers and the Nephilim and the fallen angels and chase that dog through every bush it'll run.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make sure I didn't go to the extreme on the other end, but be responsible with it. You know, wanting to be fair with the topic and to deal with the topic in a responsible manner. The first thing that I set about was to try and get a clear understanding of the timeline of when the Watchers were interacting with men, when apparently this interaction between the Watchers and or the fallen angels and the daughters of men took place, when the Nephilim were produced.
Yes.
And lay that out. We get plenty of references from the New Testament as it was in the days of Noah. And so I really wanted to get a timeline there. Going through the Book of Jubilees, I find a reference to, as it's going through the genealogy of those that were born, we find a reference to a man named Jared, who is actually the father of Enoch. And we are told that in his day is when the Watchers descended upon the earth. I think that's in Jubilees chapter 4.
Yeah.
That during his time is when the Watchers descended. In fact, that's what his name, excuse me, that's what his name means. Well, Jared is born about 461 years from the creation, the Garden of Eden story, Adam and Eve. So we've got about a 461-year span of time. Shortly after that, we're given the birth of his son Enoch, the birth of his son Methuselah, the birth of his son Lamech, and eventually the birth of Lamech's son Noah. It is during the time of Methuselah's birth that things really seem to change. Methuselah's name has a very strange ring to it. The back meaning or the backstory of his name means men of shooting weapons. And that is kind of an odd thing to name a child. You would
it
think
sure is
going on at that time. So something very drastic has changed between the time that the Watchers initially came in the days of Jared and the time that Methuselah is born. And that's where I really wanted to settle in with the timeline. One of the things that I found in my research is that it seems the Watchers had an initial mission or a commission, so to speak, to be teachers of men. In fact, I think we could take that from the Book of Jubilees, that they are declared to be those who would instruct the children of men.
Yes.
They should do judgment and uprightness in the earth.
Yes.
So I think they had a benevolent mission originally. I don't think they came here on accident. I don't think they came here against the will of heaven. But it's very clear through several ancient texts that a number of them, and the Book of Enoch puts the number at 200, that a number of them decided to abandon that mission and seek out their own will, and to try to carve out their own legacy. This is where you have this interaction with the daughters of men, which the Book of Genesis tells us they were taken. The word there is a forceful taken. So
yes.
It seemed they were taken against their will, and they produced offspring. These offspring were hybrids. They were a mixture of a eternal, heavenly creation, an angelic being, and the daughters of men a human being. And these hybrids were aberrations that never belonged on the planet. But as I followed the timeline, the Book of Enoch says that the initial birth of these hybrid beings only spanned a period of about 500 years or less. That takes us up to a period that's only about 1,000 years removed from our initial creation. Well, Noah's not even born yet.
Right.
So that's where I really began to settle down and look at the text and say, if our reference is to things that were going on in the days of Noah, how is that different than the story of the fallen angels and the daughters of men and the production of the Nephilim? And it seems quite evident that although the first generation Nephilim killed themselves off through war, that they did produce additional offspring. And these additional offspring were busy about the task of wrestling the earth from the very ones that God had gifted it to, which were Adam and his descendants. Yes. And so when I mentioned a while ago that the world was a very violent place, I think that bears out in the story. And this is the world that Noah was born into.
Yes, yes, very chaotic. Why was Noah chosen, Mark? I mean, Lamech had other sons, so what was so special about Noah?
Now, that's really interesting because you're right. Lamech did have other sons. And the book of Genesis tells us that, you know, first of all, it gives us the background of Noah as far as his lineage and gives us a direct bloodline all the way back to Adam through the line of Seth, which is put there for a reason and a direct purpose. The book of Enoch also gives us some amazing insight about the birth of Noah. His birth was actually prophesied by Enoch. But when Noah's born, and I'm taking this out of the 106th chapter of the book of Enoch, when Noah's born, it gives this description to him. His body was white as snow and red as the blooming of a rose. The hair of his head was white as wool. His eyes were beautiful. When he opened his eyes, they lit up the whole house like the sun, and the whole house very bright. And when he was taken from the hands of the midwife, he opened his mouth and spoke to the Lord of righteousness. And his father Lamech was afraid of him and fled and came to his father Methuselah and said unto him, I have begotten a strange son. Yeah, I think you have.
Yeah.
The initial birth of Noah, even his own father, realized this child is different. I think, Mike, as I look back through many of our Old Testament prophets and some of the Old Testament greats such as Abraham, you know, there's so many that we could hang our hat on, just heroes of the faith and ones that we would say are just absolutely dripping with the power of God. I think of prophets like Daniel who, you know, prayed and had the entirety of the span of human history revealed unto him. Yes. Daniel, who stood before Nebuchadnezzar and said, you know, King, your kingdom's not going to last forever. Let me fill you in on some things here.
Yeah.
Isaiah, who said, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. I mean, Isaiah, the book of Isaiah is just an amazing book. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet who cried for his people. Ezekiel, who saw things that we're still trying to explain.
Right.
All of these were great patriarchs of the faith. But when you get into the Old Testament, only two people have this particular phrase said about them. And he walked with God.
Yes.
One of them is Enoch.
Yeah.
The other's Noah. And if they are the only two who have that phrase attributed to them, that tells me that they were different. Not only was Noah of the pure bloodline, but Noah was of pure righteousness from the time that he was a child.
Yeah.
And I think that's what set him apart.
Yeah. Wow. That is very, very interesting. You said that was the 106th chapter of Enoch that
describes. It's the 106th chapter of the book of Enoch. And I'll tell you, I mentioned the Book of Enoch several times in my volume there, and I do my best when I introduce it to give logical reasons as to why I feel like it can be accepted as a text worthy of consideration. I can't say that it hasn't been tampered with it. I don't believe that is a wholly inspired text that should be a part of our biblical canon.
Right.
But I do believe that there's something very special about that book. It was a part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Book of Enoch was in there, the same book that we can buy today, with a few exceptions. There are some chapters that are in here that are very clearly added to the book.
Yeah.
But there's something very very unique about that book, and I think it's terrific reading. I really do.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment, Mark. I think that's fair and balanced approach to the Book of Enoch. Now, Methuselah, you discuss a very unique, curious, significant role that he played in Noah's life.
Methuselah was the son of Enoch, and we know him as the man who lived the longest lifespan. That's really, when you ask, our Sunday scholars, Methuselah, what can you tell me about Methuselah? Well, lived the longest life of anyone on the face of the earth. But Methuselah served a very special role. I think he was gifted with a number of things. Quite evident that he was a go-between his father and Lamech and his son in some instances, in many instances. But also, Lamech, Noah's father, died at a young age. And we're not told why he died or what happened, but we are told that he lived to the ripe young age of 777.
Interesting. Interesting number.
Well, and about 130 years or so less than what seemed to be the norm at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of people say, how can you justify all these old ages that these people lived, 900 years and 900 years and 930 years? And you know what? That seems to have been the norm.
Yeah.
Whereas in our day and time, the norm is 70, 75 years. If you live to be 100 years, you're really something special and been blessed with some really good health.
Right.
At that time, to live around 900 years was kind of the lifespan. That was kind of the norm. Methuselah plays a very important role in Noah's life because Noah's father, Lamech, passes away at an earlier age. And you find in many cases it's Methuselah that is doing the hands-on leadership in Noah's life as opposed to his father. And it's Methuselah that stands with Noah when he faces the children of men. And it's Methuselah that, when it comes time for Noah's three sons to have wives, it's Methuselah that bridges that gap. And he goes to find the three wives, which were also a part of the lineage, as we revealed in the book, for the three sons. So Methuselah played a very special role. And as the ancient texts reveal, Methuselah died approximately 1 week before the flood actually happened.
Yes.
He passed away. Noah, his sons, their wives, were aboard the ark for 7 days before the flood started. But Methuselah passed away just prior to that.
Yeah. You also answer one of the questions that many people are troubled by, Mark. Why was it necessary for God to destroy the entire world of living things rather than just the wicked?
I think that's one of the questions that really troubled me a lot, Mike. It's very evident in other portions of Scripture when you have wickedness going on that, God can hit a moving target. I mean, it's... I think of the time of Joshua and the illustration of Achan, who stole some things from Jericho. Wasn't supposed to, but he took them. And all of a sudden, we've got sin in the camp, and we need to find this sin. And I think that's just an illustration of how, when it comes down to one man or one family, how much God can center in on that. We also have the illustration of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain, where wickedness is widespread and he can judge entire cities or a group of cities. It's easy for us sometimes to, when we think and see the wickedness in our world today, Mike, it's easy for us sometimes to take the approach of, you know, if I could just get into God's collection of lightning bolts, I'd waste a few.
Right.
And with just cause.
Yeah.
What doesn't sometimes stick with us is that when Abraham was told that God was going to destroy Sodom for the wickedness, that Abraham actually bargained with God. And I think he bargained with God not only because Lot was there, but also because people were there.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, if I can find 50 righteous, what about if I can find 40? And he bargained all the way down to 10. That tells us that God's judgment can be persuaded. And it also tells us what our role is. You know, we should be compassionate towards mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Peter said, God is long suffering, not willing that any should perish.
Right.
So many times we're quick to be on the other side of that aisle, just saying, give me a lightning bolt. I got a target in view.
Yeah.
But as you get back to the ancient world, that was the question that I really had, was why the entire world had to be destroyed. And we spent some time in the book talking about the doctrine of emanations, which I believe became a widespread belief in that day and time. One of the things that the fallen angels did, and specifically an angel named Azazel, or Azazel as some people would pronounce it, one of the things that they did was they taught man about the magic of nature, and as opposed to teaching people about the majesty of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
Man's focus changed. The idea behind the doctrine of emanations is that as God created, he poured more and more of himself into the creation, and eventually emptying himself into creation to where there is no longer an entity that is God, but there is nature and God is in nature. That's a teaching that we have even to this day.
Yes.
And it's a widespread teaching, and it's a very dangerous teaching.
Yes.
I think the main reason for the flood, not the only, but the main reason for the flood, was to clearly differentiate between the two. The Creator created creation and nature. He is not creation and nature. They are eternally different. And in destroying the entirety of creation, that message is sent. Because if God was in nature, if God was in creation, then he would be destroying himself in so doing.
Yes.
He very clearly sends the message that I am different from creation.
Yes, amen.
It's just something I made, but it is not who I am. So I think that really played out very strongly. There's also a reference in the book of Jasher, and I'd have to look it up to see what chapter it is. I think it's chapter 4 or 5, of just as the flood is beginning, people coming to the ark. Noah and his family are closed into the ark, but people coming to the ark and screaming to Noah. This is something that we remember from our childhood Sunday school stories that actually seems to be accurate.
Yeah.
People screaming to Noah saying, let us in, let us on board, let us. And Noah saying, do you not remember when I spoke to you, how you told me there is no God?
Yeah.
They separated themselves from that. And
yeah,
it comes back to remembrance. When I think of the New Testament passage as it was in the days of Noah, some of these things really stand out to me.
Yes. One of the hotly contested topics is the topic of the Nephilim. Is it your opinion, Mark, that they were completely eradicated? And the reason I ask that is because some scholars and researchers suggest that they're active again today. Now, I've asked that question of a number of different people. And so I'm real interested in what you have to say about that.
I'm going to say yes, they were completely eradicated because, as we just read in Genesis a few minutes ago, it says that everything that drew the breath of life died.
Yes.
So they were completely eradicated. I am also going to tell you that they rear their head again on the other side of the flood. And I do not believe that it's a second incursion of angels. There are some that are of that opinion. I do believe there are fallen angels at work in the world today. Paul very clearly told us that. He said, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. That's borne out in the book of Daniel. There's numerous references that seem to make it apparently abundantly clear that there are angels in the world today, or angelic beings, I should say, in the world today, that are not doing the will of our Creator, but doing the will of our divine enemy. But I do think that the bloodline of the Nephilim survived through the flood and to the other side. And I'm going to kind of unravel that knot a little bit more in the second book that I'm working on.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, we know through the books of Joshua, Judges, Kings, Samuel, Chronicles, that the Nephilim bloodline is alive and well in the post-flood world. It's very evident.
Yes.
I think that's the main reason why Joshua and the children of Israel are told when they go into the land of Canaan that there are certain tribes that they are to completely eliminate.
Yes.
Do not keep anything of theirs, all the way down to the animals and the possessions and the belongings. Everything was to be destroyed. Why? Because they were of Nephilim bloodline, and that is an abomination to God, and had to be destroyed. I think it's very clear. I think it's very evident, and I can't argue with it.
Right.
I think it paints a wonderful picture for us, a juxtaposition that we miss on the other side of the flood, when Noah and Methuselah stand to the children of men and plead with them to return to serving the Creator and worshiping the Creator, and they just can't do it. They don't have that faith to, you know, leave their wickedness, so to speak, and turn to the Creator. Well, the other thing that we mentioned earlier was the world was a very violent place. They were under the thumb of Nephilim rulership at that time. I don't know that they had the trust in God to help them fight those battles against the Nephilim. We don't read that in Genesis, but I think I can make a case for it, because we do read it in the book of Joshua when he's 12 spies in the Canaan, and they come back, and Joshua and Caleb, when Moses sends the spies over, Joshua and Caleb are two of the spies to come back and say, hey, let's go get them. What a wonderful land God's given us. And, you know, God led us out of Egypt. He led us through the desert. He, you know, parted the Red Sea. And there is milk and honey and flowing and grapes so big that you can't hardly wrap your arms around them. Let's go get it. And one of them said, you know what? There's giants and we're grasshoppers in their sight, and I just don't think we can do this. What was the response? The response from God was, this is a wicked generation that will
pass
in the wilderness. And I think that's exactly what happened on the other side of the flood. They would not turn back to the Creator. They had no faith in God. They said, no, it's not a God that's going to fight for us to win this battle. God said, you will perish in the flood.
Yes.
You perish in the flood. So a lot of things going on there, Mike.
Yes, absolutely there is. And I encourage our listeners to do some research on that on their own. Mark, you mentioned just a few moments ago you've got another book in the works. Is that My End of the Circle by any chance?
My End of the Circle is one of them I'm working on. And that's really, it really deals with a few of the sleeping dogs that we kind of tiptoed past and didn't have to, you know, wake up while we're going through this book. A few things there I want to get back into. One of the things I want to get back into is we touched lightly on the sacrifice in Eden. I want to spend a little more time with that. I touched lightly on the identification of sin. And this is something that in all of my reading, I really haven't come across someone that that I feel like brings out some of the things that the Lord has shown me in my own personal walk and my own personal study. Sin is very personal. Sin is very alive. It's almost, I'm reminded of the verse in Genesis 4 when Cain and Abel bring their offering, And we touched on this just briefly in the book. This is one of those sleeping dogs. But Cain and Abel bring their offering. And Abel's offering is accepted and Cain's is not. Well, there's a conversation in Genesis 4 between the Lord and Cain. And Cain is told, if you do well, do you not know that you'll also be accepted? Well, that seems to imply that he had done well in the past,
right.
That he'd done the right thing, yes. Maybe, because God's asking, don't you know? You know, don't you understand that you'll be accepted if you do it, if you do things right? But it says, if you don't, sin lieth at the door. And here's the direct words out of Genesis 4. Sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire. Sin is a personage.
Mm.
It's very clearly spelled out there. Romans chapter 5, Paul says, wherefore is by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And we take that as to we're all born into this sin nature. But Paul goes on to say, for all have sinned. He says we're all participants.
Mm.
We've all been active in this interaction with sin. It seems to very clearly be a personage. James says we're led away of our own lust. So I want to dig into that a little
bit.
So all of that is in the book, My End of the Circle. And I titled that because these are kind of circular arguments. I don't know that there's going to be any dogmatic conclusion to any of these things.
Yeah. When do you anticipate that one being finished and available, Mark?
I anticipated that one being finished and available this summer. But
okay.
That tells you anywhere as to where, you know, how far behind I am on some of those things. But hopefully we'll have some of that ready to go to final edits by the spring, and maybe we can get it forward there. I'm also, one of my biggest distractions is working on the companion volume to the book, End the Beginning. I'm blessed, Mike, I'm blessed with an absolutely amazing wife. I love her with all my heart. We've been together for 4 years, just got married this past April. But one of the tremendous blessings I have is that my wife grew up in the state of Montana and did not grow up in a church. So she doesn't have all of the lifetime of Sunday school teaching that so many people here in the southern part of the United States where I live have. She just absolutely does not, you know, through no fault of her own, just as a part of her, you know, the area she grew up in. And in so doing, it was very helpful as I was writing this book because I had someone who wasn't overly familiar with the story. And it really kept me in check of making sure that as I'm trying to put these puzzle pieces together, it's something that those who are familiar with the story can follow along and can point counterpoint, you know, along the way. But those who aren't familiar with the story can pick this book up and follow it through and not have to have a tremendous theological background to understand where we're going.
Yes.
And that's really something I wanted to accomplish. I have some of the best feedback that I've gotten from folks is from those who, and I have a number of friends who are atheistic in their belief. And I've had a few of them tell me, I don't believe a word of this, but I can't put it down.
That's great.
That to me, it tells me that, you know, that I had tremendous guidance in putting this together, and I thank the Lord for that.
Yes.
But I also thank my wife for that, because she was one of my proofreaders along the way, and she questioned me on a number of things that I had to go back and wrestle with to make sure that I wasn't leaving some of those behind who weren't as familiar with the story. Well, the flip side of that coin is she is now wanting to know how an 8-person campsite developed into the nations of the ancient world. So it's like, I need book 2. You've got, and so that's where we're going with book 2.
Awesome.
Try to bridge those gaps and pull that together. And it's an exciting study.
Absolutely. Your website is markcombsauthor.com. Markcombsauthor.com. Listeners can get In the Beginning there, available on your website, and I believe it's available through Amazon and outlets like that as well, isn't it?
It's available through any outlet where you can purchase a book, whatever your favorite resource is. We also just released it a couple of weeks ago as an ebook. I had a number of people asking me when the ebook would come out, and we had a lot of additional edits in the ebook because so many in this book you saw the number of footnotes that are in the book. Well, yes. In the ebook, every single one of those footnotes is a hot link. There was absolutely
excellent.
Additional editing to do in the East.
Yes.
And it took a while, but we just recently released it. But it's available through any type of bookstore outlet, Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, both in ebook and printed copy form. And just so your listeners will know, my first name, Mark, is spelled with a K, not with a C. MarkCombsAuthor.com. There's also a place on that website where they can find me on Facebook or on Twitter, or sign up for my newsletter, all of that.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, and I encourage folks to sign up for that newsletter. I did, and I try to keep track of guests that appear on the show and keep up on what is happening in their lives. I think we've got a lot more that we can tackle, Mark, and I'd like to do that in another show if you're willing.
I'd be honored. This has been fun. I really appreciate it. And if we want to get together and do this again, I would gladly set aside the time.
That would be awesome. I appreciate that. Folks, thanks for listening to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. Again, Mark's website is markcombsauthor.com. The name of the book is In the Beginning. Go to the website and you can keep up with everything that's going on with Mark. Thanks so much, Mark, for joining me for this episode.
Thank you.
God bless.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, PastorMike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.